Thanks very much, Celia. If we can just have the point up. So, as Celia said, it really does read very much like a Sunday school story, and if you remember it from Sunday school, maybe that's what we should be studying about this evening. Does everyone get it? Yes. Ducking seven times in muddy water. That's a terrible joke, isn't it? We lost it. Oh. Sorry, my cable fell out. Right. So, this story today is fairly familiar to us all, as Celia said. And it's about Elisha and this Syrian general, Naaman. But actually, in this story, unlike the others we've been reading about Elisha, Elisha's not actually that big a character. He's quite minor, and I think certainly as a child, the bit about Gehazi, the servant, was the bit which is much easier to relate to. But what I'd like to look at this evening from it is the question of who gets the glory? And we'll go through the various characters in the story, but we'll start, first of all, with the young servant girl. If you look in verses 2 to 4 of the passage, and we'll refer quite a lot to the passage, but we won't be doing too much other flicking about in the Bible, so it's good to keep it open. So in verses 2 to 4, you can read about the servant girl and her faith. Now, bands of raiders from Aram had gone out and taken a young girl from Israel, and she served Naaman's wife. She said to her mistress, "If only my master would see the prophet who is in Samaria, he would cure him of his leprosy." Naaman went to his master and told him what the girl from Israel had said. Now, we know very little about this servant girl beyond what's written in these couple of verses. So what we can ascertain is that she was an Israelite. She was young, and it seems she was most likely not yet a teenager. She was a captive, she was a servant, and that she had heard of Elisha and Elijah and believed what she had heard. Now, as a captive servant, you wouldn't necessarily have expected her to be that kind thinking towards her masters. But she showed a real deep concern for Naaman and seeking to find a cure for his leprosy. But what I'd really like to look at is her faith. See, this little girl, she clearly believed in a God who could and would heal. And the surprising thing is not so much the fact that she believed in a God who could heal, but who would consider healing the general of one of Israel's worst enemies of the time. And the captain of the enemy army, that's sort of putting Israel in a bit of a risk if the enemy army general is kept in good health. You'd have thought you'd be praying for God instead to strike him down or something like that. But she believed in a God who could and would heal him. And I think if we look at the story of Jonah, we can see sort of what we'd expect to be a more typical attitude of the Israelites at the time towards their enemies, where Jonah just wanted the Assyrians at that time to be destroyed and was really upset about God having mercy on them. But this girl, she put her life at risk because you can imagine, she tells her master, Naaman, "Go to Israel, go to your enemy, there's a prophet there who can heal you," and he goes there with all his money and pomp and ceremony and everything and tries to get healing. And if he comes back unhealed, it doesn't really bode well for the future of that girl at all, does it? But she was willing to take a risk and to show the love and the faith in God as well, and to meet Naaman's biggest need, or what he considered to be his biggest need at the time. And who got the glory from it? The glory was going very much to God. Second character in the story, doesn't do quite so well, is the king of Israel. Now, Israel, as we've seen over the last couple of weeks at this time, was quite an idol-worshipping nation and wasn't really following God. They'd long since abandoned him, and they were content to go their own ways. And their king at the time, Joram, was little better than his predecessors. Now, he would have seen God's power at work through Elisha. In particular, if we look back just to chapter 3, a few years earlier, Elisha had prophesied a miracle to provide water for his starving army, and then given a miraculous defeat of the Moabites, even though Elisha didn't think there was anything at all good in Joram himself. But in today's passage, in verse 7, the king of Israel doesn't think at all about Elisha. Instead, as soon as the king of Israel read the letter, he tore his robes and said, "Am I God? Can I kill and bring back to life? Why does this fellow send someone to me to be cured of his leprosy? See how he's trying to pick a quarrel with me." So despite all the facts that he knew about God and about Elisha, despite his own experiences of God at work, in this story, when he was faced with a seemingly impossible demand, his response was just one of despair. It doesn't seem as if he even considered God or Elisha might be able to help with his problems, and he certainly didn't give God any glory at all. But before we get too critical of Joram, let's just think a bit about our own lives, about situations when we may have faced a bit of feeling of despair. When that comes, how do you respond? Do you turn to God? Or do you turn to some other kind of comfort? To TV, to shopping, to the internet, to family, to alcohol? It's really easy when difficulties arise to kind of feel that we can cope with them by ourselves, or despair that we can't cope with them by ourselves. But it's actually how we respond that really shows where our faith truly lies. Well, we may not manage to turn to God as our first response, which would be the sensible thing. He should at least be pretty high on our list, because he is the one who loves us, and he is the one who is powerful and is able to make a difference to our situations. The next character on the list is Naaman himself. Now, Naaman was the general of the Aramean army, which in some translations comes across as the Syrian army. They seem to be fairly synonymous at the time. And it seems that he'd probably distinguished himself in battles against the Assyrians, who were the up-and-coming enemy from a little bit further east. But as I said, he was the general in charge of the army of one of God's people's enemies. And at the time of this story, they were in a kind of a state of uneasy peace. Technically, they weren't at war with Israel, but they'd still be sending out these little raiding parties to opportunistically see what they could get from the Israelites, what they could steal, and so it was very much an uneasy peace. And it would have been one of these raiding parties that would have gone out and taken some captives, one of which was this Israelite girl. And probably Naaman would have bought her as a servant from the raiding party to be a servant for his wife. So, in verses 1 to 3, we read a little bit about Naaman. Naaman was commander of the army of the king of Aram. He was a great man in the sight of his master and highly regarded, because through him the Lord had given victory to Aram. He was a valiant soldier, but he had leprosy. Now bands of raiders from Aram had gone out and taken captive a young girl from Israel, and she served Naaman's wife. She said to her mistress, "If only my master would see the prophet who's in Samaria, he would cure him of his leprosy." So Naaman could clearly see that he had a problem, and everyone else could see it as well. Leprosy. He couldn't ignore it, and it clearly bothered him and his king so much that in the following verses, they were willing to spend a lot of money, and we're talking millions of pounds in silver and gold here in today's money, to be able to find a cure. But what Naaman didn't realise was that he had a much bigger problem than the physical one which he could see. And his problem was pride. Now, his pride was fairly understandable. He'd achieved great victories and probably had the second highest position in his land. But that still doesn't make pride good or excusable. He had great faith, but his faith was in himself and his own ability, which probably made the leprosy, which was defeating him now, even worse, as it was something that was completely outside of his control. But what he hadn't realised, if we look back in verse 1, was it wasn't him that had won the victory for Aram, it was God that had given him the victory. Let's just stop and think for a moment about our own pride, about your pride. What effect does your pride have on you? Does it stop you from doing something which you should? Or does it stop you apologising to someone? Or keep you at distance in a broken relationship? Proverbs 16, verse 18 famously says, "Pride goes before destruction, a haughty spirit before a fall." If we continue reading about Naaman, starting at verse 8, when Elisha, the man of God, heard that the king of Israel had torn his robes, he sent him this message. "Why have you torn your robes? Have the man come to me, and he will know that there is a prophet in Israel." So Naaman went with his horses and chariots and stopped at the door of Elisha's house. Elisha sent a messenger to him to say, "Go wash yourself 7 times in the Jordan, and your flesh will be restored, and you'll be cleansed." But Naaman went away angry and said, "I thought that he would surely come out to me and stand and call on the name of the Lord his God, wave his hand over me, over the spot, and cure me of my leprosy. Are not Abana and Pharpar, the rivers of Damascus, better than all the waters of Israel? Can't I just wash in them and be cleansed?" He turned and went off in a rage. Naaman's servants went to him and said, "My father, if the prophet had told you to do some great thing, would you not have done it? How much more then when he tells you, wash and be cleansed?" So he went down and dipped himself in the Jordan 7 times as the man of God had told him, and his flesh was restored and became clean like that of a young boy. When Elisha confronts Naaman's pride, firstly by making him come to his house rather than going to him, then by sending a servant out with a message rather than seeing him face to face, and then telling him to wash in Israel's muddy river 7 times, Naaman was very understandably furious. I think I probably would have been in that situation. He must have felt like the Israelites were making fun of him, because being mocked is something that pride really hates. C.S. Lewis said, "Pride is a spiritual cancer. It eats up the very possibility of love or contentment or even common sense." Naaman's servants, though, managed to gently talk him round to taking the risk of humbling himself and doing what he'd been told and washing 7 times in the Jordan. The result, of course, was a miracle. The Jordan couldn't cure him. It was his faith and his action based on his faith that cured him. God working through Naaman's faith. He may only have had the faith just like the size of a mustard seed, thinking, well, might as well do it, I'll try and see, but not really expecting it. But still, he had a little bit of faith that there was a tiny hope of it happening, and he went and he obeyed. As Jesus said, what takes is the faith the size of a mustard seed. But the bigger miracle which came about in this story was probably the change in his heart. Because as he humbled himself, God was able to deal with his pride, and he was able to recognize that Elisha's God was the one and only true God, as no God had ever been known to heal anyone from leprosy. Pride, bitterness, resentment, they're all modern-day cancers of our hearts. And there's plenty of attested medical evidence to show that these things affect our bodies. If you have any pride or resentment or bitterness in your own heart, don't leave this evening without dealing with it and resolving to restore any broken relationships you may have. Just taking a first step of talking peacefully with someone who you may harbour anger towards is a first step towards healing, and it can only do good things for your relationship with them, and your physical health. But when we look at the change in Naaman, we can also clearly see that he attributed the change in his skin to God. In verse 15, then Naaman and all his attendants went back to the man of God. He stood before him and said, now I know that there is no God in all the world except in Israel. And in verse 17, please let me, your servant, be given as much earth as a pair of mules can carry. For your servant will never again make burnt offerings and sacrifices to any other god but the Lord. Naaman had recognized that God, the one and only true God, is the one with the true power. And he decided that he would worship Elisha's God alone. In humbling himself, in rejecting his pride, Naaman was giving God glory. And the next character for us to look at is Elisha. Well, he doesn't appear so much in the first part of the story, except in verse 8. When Elisha, the man of God, heard that the king of Israel had torn his robes, he sent him this message. Why have you torn your robes? Have the man come to me and he'll know there's a prophet in Israel. And then, in verse 15 to 16, Naaman and all his attendants went back to the man of God. He stood before him and said, now I know that there is no God in all the world except in Israel, so please accept a gift from your servant. The prophet answered, as surely as the Lord lives, whom I serve, I will not accept a thing. And even though Naaman urged him, he refused. In initially telling Joram to send Naaman to him, Elisha was confident that God was going to use him to heal Naaman. Of course, his faith in God is well placed. But he realized also that Naaman's greater need was not so much to be free from his leprosy, but his pride. And Elisha's faith in God was such that he was not scared to rudely ignore the general of the most dangerous enemy that Israel currently had, and to infuriate him by just passing on a message via a servant that he should humble himself and go wash in a dirty river. Not generally a good way to preserve your life expectancy, talking to someone like that. But Elisha knew that that was what God wanted for Naaman, and that just as God could heal Naaman, he could also take care of Naaman's reaction and preserve Elisha's life. The important thing for Elisha to do was just to obey God and to say God's word regardless of the consequences. Because Elisha was more concerned about God getting the glory. I don't know if you've ever come to church and been offended by what the preacher or the worship leader said. When that happens, it's worth trying to consider for a moment whether it was actually God that was trying to speak to you. And if you were maybe offended because it touched on some sin in your life that you prefer not to face up to. The problem then is not with the preacher or worship leader. It's a problem that God wants you to deal with. And if God speaks to you, it may well infuriate you. I know there's times when I felt God speaking to me and I felt a bit upset and angry and I don't want to do what God says. But when you feel that, it's important that you do not harden your heart, but rather humble yourself as Naaman did and consider whether you might actually be in the wrong and in need of changing your action. So on to the final character we'll look at in the story, which is Gehazi. Gehazi is Elisha's servant. And if we remember that Elisha began his prophetic career as the servant of Elijah, then Gehazi may have been assuming that he was going to be heir to Elisha's role, just as Elisha had been to Elijah, and that one day he might be the main prophet for Israel. However, as we see in this story, it was unlikely to ever be the case. So in verse 19, go in peace, Elisha said. After Naaman had travelled some distance, Gehazi, the servant of Elisha, the man of God, said to himself, my master was too easy on Naaman, this Aramean, by not accepting from him what he brought. As surely as the Lord lives, I'll run after him and get something from him. So Gehazi hurried after Naaman. When Naaman saw him running towards him, he got down from his chariot to meet him. "Is everything all right?" he asked. "Everything is all right," Gehazi answered. "My master sent me to say, 2 young men from the company of the prophets have just come to me from the hill country of Ephraim. Please give them a talent of silver and 2 sets of clothing." "By all means, take 2 talents," said Naaman. He urged Gehazi to accept them and then tied up the 2 talents of silver in 2 bags with 2 sets of clothing. He gave them to 2 of his servants and they carried them ahead of Gehazi. When Gehazi came to the hill, he took the things from the servants and put them away in the house. He sent the men away and they left. When he went in and stood before his master, Elisha asked him, "Where have you been, Gehazi?" "Your servant didn't go anywhere," Gehazi answered. But Elisha said to him, "Was not my spirit with you when the man got down from his chariot to meet you? Is this the time to be taking money or accepting clothes or olive groves and vineyards or flocks and herds or male and female slaves? Naaman's leprosy will cling to you and your descendants forever." Then Gehazi went from Elisha's presence and his skin was leprous. It had become as white as snow. In last week's story, John told us how Gehazi, whose name means Valley of Vision, had good insight into the needs of the Shunammite woman and her desire for a son. And in this part of the story, Gehazi shows, though, what else is in his heart. Greed. Reminds me a bit of the story of Ananias and Sapphira and how they lied to God and the punishment they received for their lies. Gehazi clearly felt as if he and Elisha had a right to a reward from Naaman's healing, particularly as it's a foreigner who was offering it. The problem with asking for some kind of recompense was not that they were undeserving, because, well, how else would a prophet live unless he accepts some kinds of gifts? The problem was that Elisha has been trying to make it abundantly clear in everything that the miracle was entirely due to God and not to them and their own power. There's nothing inherent in Elisha or Gehazi. It was entirely of God. But then, when confronted, Gehazi just made the problem worse by lying to cover up his greed. Now, this is a bit of a natural human instinctive reaction, self-protection. And those of us who've had children can testify to many stories like, "Who ate the chocolate?" "Not me, I don't know." "Why is your face covered with chocolate?" "I won't name any children on that one." What Gehazi needed at this point, though, was some of Naaman's humility. The outcome may well have been a bit different if, when confronted by his sin, he didn't just try to cover it up, but instead had humbly confessed and asked for forgiveness. But by holding on to his pride and lying about it, the result was that he inherited Naaman's leprosy. And here we see the contrast between Elisha's faith and Gehazi's. Gehazi clearly trusted in what he could see as what he needed, and taking the opportunity to get rich rather than to glorify God. Do we do any better when faced with the opportunities of something which would be more work, which would give us more money, or finding ways of serving God with our time, being content with what we have? What's our choice? Unfortunately, money is often way too high a priority in our minds. When Jesus asked people to follow him, he talked about giving up everything and taking up our cross and following him. And he talked about not worrying about money, as God has it in hand. God will provide. The desire for more money by working longer hours, which takes us away from time with God and family, is a great danger. It's so easy to fall into. But sometimes maybe we should ask ourselves the question, so if I don't have more money, then what is it that I won't be able to have or do? But then following that up with, but then does God really want me to have or to do that thing which I need the money for? And it can be quite humbling when you see that what you think are your needs are actually just wants, and God doesn't think that they're important or necessary at all. And in fact, actually there could be more distractions away from him. I'm not saying we should all give up work, but we just shouldn't allow work to control us or money to control us. We need to still have time for God and for others. Just need to trust that God will provide for all we need rather than what we want. So, as we look at the four characters, we also need to look at our own faith. Our actions betray what we have by way of faith. If we have the same God as Elisha had, a God that doesn't change, who's the same yesterday, today, and forever, then how should that affect our trust in him? God is totally reliable. He'll never let us down. And he also knows what is best for us. What he wants is for us to seek to give him the glory in everything. He wants us to humble ourselves, to get rid of our pride, confessing our sin and greed and self-reliance, to seek his ways instead. As Matthew 6:33 says, "Seek first his kingdom and his righteousness, and all these things will be given to you as well."